You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, January 24th, 2017, the feast day of St. Francis de Sales. My pleasure to be with you, Mike Allen, here on Breadbox Media. Going to be a fun show today. A couple of guests lined up, actually, at the bottom of the hour. We'll be talking to Dr. Stephen Bullivant, who teaches at St. Mary's University in the Benedict XVI Center for Theology over there. He's been a guest before, former atheist who, with the help of Bob Dylan, came to the faith and to the Catholic faith. I'm friends with him on Facebook and noted that he had recently made a trip from England over to Houston, Texas, where he was the guest of a professor at Houston Baptist University, an evangelical school down there. And while he was there, he also had the opportunity to speak at a large mega church, which, if you've ever been to Houston, quite honestly, you can't throw a rock in any direction without hitting an enormous evangelical church. The old saying that things are bigger in Texas, that's not a lie. So he was at Champion Forest Baptist Church and actually wrote a Catholic Herald article about it. He was invited by a Baptist lawyer who's considered to be one of the top criminal lawyers in America, Mark Lanier, who also happens to love theology. And Stephen, of course, has written a book on the Trinity, How Not to Be a Heretic, basically. And they invited him to come. The Houston Baptist invited him to come. But while there, he had the opportunity to speak to a large Sunday school gathering, really, several hundred people there at Champion Forest Baptist Church. So it was his first experience of a mega church. So I look forward to hearing from him about that and also his experience at the U.S. Ordinariates, the Anglican Ordinariate, or for former Anglicans, Impressive Cathedral Parish. Maybe he could tell us a little bit about that, too. But Stephen Bullivant at the bottom of the hour. And in the second hour, we're going to have Jason Hall on the program. Jason, political junkie as he is, I know we'll have some thoughts on the recent inauguration and all that's unfolded since then, but we're going to try to also kind of keep it fun today, and we'll talk movies, we'll talk TV, and also going to talk about something I touched on a little bit last week. I actually ended up writing an article about this for the upcoming edition of our diocesan newspaper, about how we're going to talk about how our perspective of being Catholic has changed since actually becoming Catholic, because there is a shift, and it's an important one that happens. I think it's much not unlike the shift that happens in marriage when you realize you haven't just bound yourself to the idea of marriage. You have bound yourself to a real person. So that's what we'll talk about when I have Jason on the program. So it should be fun. I'll give you the question of the day in the next segment. 573-4-BREAD-4, of course, if you want to be on the program at all today. 573-4-BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Would love to hear from you. Anyway, as I said today, the feast day of St. Francis de Sales. St. Francis de Sales, who was a Catholic priest in a very difficult time. It was a time of great religious tension in France. You know, if we think, this is where we get really short-sighted. You know, we see the events of this past weekend, the inauguration on Friday. We see the Women's March on Saturday. We see people leaving social media because things have become too heated, the tension, the political divisions. And sometimes in the midst of all that, we say crazy things, very historically blind things, like, this is the most divided our country's ever been. Well, now, hold on there, muchacho. We had a civil war, you remember? America has a track record of division, okay? So let's don't lose heart too much here. St. Francis de Sales, born into a time of great tension in France. He was born August 21st, 1567, and ordained to the priesthood in 1593. Now, this was right on the heels of the explosive effects of the Protestant Reformation slash revolt in Europe, including in France. You may have heard of a little group called the Huguenots and some of the tensions that went on there, bloody religious wars and all the rest. But this, according to CatholicCulture.com, as a young priest, age 26 when he was ordained, says from 1594 to 1598, he labored at the difficult and dangerous task of preaching to the Protestants of Chablais and effected the return of some 70,000 souls to the Catholic faith. Now, you got to remember, you know, the Protestant Reformation revolt did not arise out of nothing. There were problems in the church, just as there are problems in the church today. Corruption, lack of zeal, hypocrisy, poorly catechized people, all the rest. The more things change, the more they stay the same. The church is always in need of reform, always being reformed. And so some, disgusted, disillusioned with the life of what it is to be a Catholic, had left the church and to be drawn to what seemed a more vibrant, zealous Protestant faith. Well, Francis de Sales brought back 70,000 in them. Back to the faith. In 1602, so at the age of 35, he became a bishop, which I think is the minimum age one can be to be a bishop. At least it is now. I don't know if it was then. His zeal for souls is attested in 21,000 extant letters and 4,000 sermons, which exemplify how he applied St. Paul's words, "I have become all things to all men." You may epitomize his character, Catholic Culture says, in two words: kindliness and lovableness, virtues that were the secret of his success. His writings reflect his kind-heartedness and sweet disposition. Believe me, it was not a time known for sweet dispositions on matters of religious difference. But here's where De Sales is really a model evangelist for us and a model apologist in many ways, because it's the spirit in which he approached the task. I know that many of us on social media who fancy ourselves as apologists or evangelists for the Catholic faith could learn well under his tutelage. Of course, he wrote a couple of well-known books, Introduction to the Devout Life in particular. He also is known for his holy friendship and spiritual direction for St. Francis de Chantal and the dynamic, the synergy, I guess you could say, of their common desire for holiness led both of them to be canonized saints. He's also been declared a doctor of the church because of his writings. But here's a little blurb here. It says, how Francis developed his gentle and amiable disposition is a story in itself. He was not born a saint. Well, none of us are. By nature, his temperament was choleric, fiery. Little was needed to throw him into a state of violent anger. Man, I've had a couple kids like that. It took years before he mastered his impatience, his unruly temper. Even after he became bishop, there were slips. For instance, when someone rang a bell before he had finished preaching, oh man, what would he have done in the era of cell phone ringtones in the middle of a homily? The important point, of course, is that by constant perseverance, he did in time attain perfect self-mastery, wherein lies a lesson. So, St. Francis de Sales, we ask for your prayers. So it's really remarkable. He wasn't just eloquent in his speech, but he was somebody, and he was part of really a broader community in France that brought renewal. And this is the way, there's no getting around what it is that brings renewal within the church. And I mean, if you don't think the Catholic Church in the West is in desperate need of renewal, then you're not paying attention. The church is always in need of renewal, but particularly time with encroaching secularism, relativism, just the sort of the acedia or sloth that I think oftentimes settles in, the disillusionment. It's not going to begin with edicts from on high. It's not. I mean, we've lived in an age of golden popes, and even with these fantastic bishops of Rome who've been our holy fathers, the renewal at the grassroots level has been slow to take shape. It's going to happen, as it's always happened, through real men and women taking seriously their baptismal call to holiness, to love, and to making disciples. It's not for nothing that Sherry Waddell, who wrote the fantastic book Forming Intentional Disciples, which really has sparked a whole movement of understanding what it means to make intentional disciples, not just cultural Catholics, and that she lifts up St. Francis de Sales and his community as a model of really what we're looking for, people who invest in one another, who are intentional in their desire to build each other up in the faith. That's what the church needs, and there is no substitute, to put it quite simply. We'll be back in just a minute. We'll get into our question of the day and maybe take a look at a little bit of sports and our What Were You Thinking nominees. And then at the bottom of the hour, my guest will be Dr. Stephen Bullivant from St. Mary's University in England and the Benedict XVI Center for Theology. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this beautiful Tuesday, January 24th. Need your help. I'll try to promote Breadbox Media, get the word out. And one of the things we want to put together is a kind of a collage of little selfie videos, 15 to 30 seconds apiece. So if you want to take one of yourself, extolling the glories of Breadbox Media, or why you appreciate it, or maybe even a pit to one particular show, whether it's this one or any of the other great programs we have on the network, please take the selfie video. Send it to me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You can just attach it as a WMV file or whatever. I'm not technologically gifted. Or if you've got just want more information, you need to email me just at MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, and I'll try to fill you in as best I can. We'll be looking here in about 14 minutes with my guest, Stephen Bullivant, who teaches at St. Mary's University in England and also the Benedict XVI Theology Center. We'll be talking about his recent visit to a Houston megachurch, Baptist church, where he spoke to a large Sunday school gathering. Should be interesting indeed. Anyway, my question of the day, today is the 90th anniversary of the debut of Alfred Hitchcock. His first film, The Pleasure Garden, 1927. I think it was a silent film. And so I'm asking the question here of the day, what is your favorite Hitchcock film? Now, I think I've seen about five Hitchcock films. That's not including the old TV show Alfred Hitchcock Presents. I've seen Rear Window, Dial M for Murder, The Man Who Knew Too Much, The Birds, Vertigo, and I've seen Rope. Personally, I really, really, I mean, the Rear Window's great, of course, and we'll make any top 10 list, but Rope If you've never seen Rope, it's well worth it. It's set in one room, the entire thing. Of course, it's got Jimmy Stewart, who was a bit of a Hitchcock favorite. Great intellectual, psychological thriller. So anyway, I put out there the question, and you want to answer it, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll let Jason Hall weigh in next hour when he's on the program. Hitchcock, of course, who I think died in the embrace of the church, had been raised Catholic, of course, fallen away, but late in his life, struck up a friendship with a priest, and I believe received the anointing of the sick, received viaticum, I'm pretty sure. I needed to look up on that. Anyway, some responses we've gotten on Facebook, which is always an option too, Facebook or Twitter. Kathy says Rear Window. Chris says North by Northwest. That's one I haven't seen. Megan says that's difficult. Might be Rear Window. Jack says The Birds. I was traumatized by The Birds as a kid. To this day, when I go to the beach, and you know how a lot of times at very public beaches, seagulls have lost their fear of human beings. Therefore, they gather. If they sense any sort of food around, they'll gather. And my wife knows that that kind of creeps me out a little bit. And so she makes it worse and with an evil cackle, we'll pull out crackers and draw all the birds to us. No, thank you. Todd says Rear Window. Let's see. Chelsea Z, who's a regular guest, she said, I can never answer this question with just one movie. The Birds, The Wrong Man, I Confess. Yeah, I Confess. I've seen that one. That's a good about the priest who's accused of murder, knows who the killer is because it was confessed. But of course, because of the seal of the confessional, he can't say anything about it. That's really good. And Rear Window, all at the top of her list, she says. Wow. All right, so we'll get some more responses in here as we go along. But like I said, if you haven't seen Rope, you need to see it. Okay, sports-wise, I was looking last night. Man, a couple of big NBA upsets last night. Sorry about that, Alex. The Warriors on the road to the 14-30 before last night, the Miami Heat. And, you know, I looked at the box score of the game. Alex, I didn't know any of those players starting for Miami. I couldn't have told you which college they went to. And here they're beating the Warriors 105-102. Must have been a bad night for the Splash Brothers. And then, but, you know, not to be not to be underdone, I guess you could say, the Cleveland Cavaliers go on the road to New Orleans. Did you see that, Alex? Yeah, New Orleans hanging a loss on the Cavs. New Orleans, who's 18-27. Now, of course, I've got to see how my boy Anthony Davis is. They did this without Anthony Davis? Is he still out? Hurt? How long? Couple weeks? Wow. That may be even more embarrassing than losing to the Heat. So, wow. I guess it's a long grind, though, you know, 82 games, and we're kind of at about that, getting close to that midpoint. San Antonio, though, making sure it wasn't a trifecta. They took care of Brooklyn on the road. One of my favorite sports websites, sort of a clearinghouse of sports stories, Real Clear Sports. Talking about a couple things on here. One is one headline I see here, without Coach K, preseason pick Duke disintegrating. Though they seem to have rallied just a little bit. That's not sure about the timing of this article. Duke, yeah, I mean, Jeff Capel started off really bad with too bad. Oh, they lost. Duke's season of dysfunction continues with loss to Dennis Smith and NC State. Man, I didn't realize that they lost yet again. Wow. And that's at home. You know, there's some precedent for this. I mean, Duke was having, let's be honest, Duke was having some problems even before Coach K had his back surgery. Duke discovering, I mean, Duke always, of course, is heavily favored, but they were talking in almost mythic tones about this team coming into this year, kind of like that Kentucky team from a couple of years ago, the one that went 38-0 before losing to blasted Wisconsin in the Final Four. But Duke has not seemed to find the chemistry to live up to that billing, and now with Coach K sidelined, there's precedent. If you go back to, I think, the 94-95 season, Coach K was out. I think back troubles then, too. Poor Pete Gaudette came in, and the team fell apart. Losing record, didn't make the tournament. And they didn't even keep Gaudette on as an assistant afterward. So we'll see. Here's the thing, though. Be very careful in dismissing Duke. Because, as my brother-in-law likes to say, once you get to the NCAA tournament, talent rises. Beware the team, the heavily talented team that underachieved during the regular season. They may just surprise you in the tournament. And beware putting too much hope in the overachieving, under-talented team, because lack of talent gets exposed in the tournament. We'll see. And then the other thing I see, laughing in the face of age, here's another headline, Will Leach, Sports on Earth. Laughing in the face of age, Brady peaking at 39. Yeah, I'm telling you, I watched that game, at least part of it, against the Steelers the other night. I mean, Tom Brady looked 30 years old, didn't he, Alex? He looked about 30 years old. I mean, good grief. And I will say this, and I've been watching football for many, many years. And again, maybe this is the tyranny of the present. But I don't know that I can remember a Super Bowl in which you had coming into the game two quarterbacks playing at as high a level as Matt Ryan and as Tom Brady right now. I mean, you want case in point, lock solid evidence that you cannot win big in the NFL without a great elite quarterback? Look no further than the Super Bowl this year, because I'm telling you, those two guys are clearly the two best quarterbacks in their respective conferences. Anyway, let's get on to our What Were You Thinking nominees of the day. Got a couple of ones. I'm not sure if I've got three today or not. Let's see. Yeah, I like this one. This from Charleston, West Virginia. A suspicious device caused some delays at Yeager Airport in Charleston Monday, according to a news release. The suspicious item was detected at the security checkpoint. Airport officials say the bomb squad with the Kanawha County Sheriff's Department responded to the scene and found the item was an inactive grenade-type device. Was I not supposed to carry that on? I have to plead ignorance on this. It was found in a carry-on bag of an outbound passenger. Of course, you know, my stepfather says, if you want to really be safe on a plane, carry a bomb on board. Because, I mean, what are the chances there's going to be one bomb on the plane? Not very high. What are the chances there's going to be two bombs? Infinitesimal. So, maybe that's this guy's logic. Our second nominee, is going to go to an attorney. A Louisiana lawyer. You know, remember back in the day when doctors and so forth, and lawyers were paid with chickens or eggs or whatever. There's a Louisiana lawyer, I guess, who's sort of an ancient future type of thing, decided he would allow his client to pay him in marijuana, which is still, by the way, illegal in Louisiana. He's been charged. But the winner, we're going to give the winner, as always, go dumb or go home, is some people over in Great Britain have arrested a guy who, on a drunken dare, swallowed a live goldfish and live on Facebook. And now he's been arrested for causing suffering to the fish. This as opposed to putting him in a tiny glass bowl for people to stare at, or all the countless fish that are caught swallowing a live goldfish, unnecessary cruelty. We've jumped the shark, or maybe the proverbial goldfish. We'll be back in a minute with my friend Dr. Stephen Bullivant. Talk about his trip to a Houston megachurch. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
at the bottom of the hour, right back on the Mike Allen Show. Welcome in here on this Tuesday, the 24th. Blessed to have with us from England, Stephen Bullivant. Dr. Stephen Bullivant directs the Benedict XVI Center for Religion and Society at St. Mary's University in Twickenham, England. He's the author of several books, including The Trinity, How Not to Be a Heretic. He's been a guest on the program before. We're going to talk about an article that he wrote in the most recent Catholic Herald. A Catholic theologian walks into an evangelical megachurch. Watch what happens next. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's always a delight to be here. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for taking time. So you you traveled over to Houston, Texas. Huh? Have you had you've been to the States before, right?
I've been to the States quite a lot, and I kind of, you know, I go whenever I get a chance. And I'd been to Texas about 12 years ago, but only to Austin, and also cutting the sort of Texarkana corner into Louisiana. I'd never been to Houston.
It's a big old place, isn't it?
It's huge. I mean, it's much bigger than Britain.
Yeah, it's a, and you know, when you say an evangelical megachurch, that doesn't exactly narrow it down, because in Houston, you can throw a rock in almost every direction and hit. I mean, the old saying, everything's bigger in Texas. That's true when it comes to churches as well. Just giant, giant churches.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was, I mean, when I knew I was going, it wasn't the reason I went to Houston, but knowing I was going to Houston, I wanted to go and, you know, experience one of these firsthand.
And so let's just real quick, you went to Houston at the invitation of someone at Houston Baptist University, which is kind of a fast rising star in sort of evangelical maybe in the attitude, I think, is sometimes here called mere orthodoxy. You have a lot of evangelicals across various denominational stripes, and an appreciation for Catholicism as well.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some great Catholic people there. And I mean, I knew of HBU because of people in Catholic circles recommending their, I think it's an MA in apologetics. And there's someone called Holly Ordway who teaches on it. And so it was kind of on my radar as, you know, a good place where good things are happening, even before I, you know, made the contact that led to the trip.
And so what was it that prompted the Jerry Johnson from HBU to invite you over? Was it your book on the Trinity? Was some of your other writing?
No, it was he's working on a big documentary focusing on the nuns, you know, the people who have no religion. And we'd met up a couple of times last year to be interviewed for this big documentary. So I met him in London, met him again in Oxford. And the last time I met him, he said, you know, well, come over to Houston and, you know, we can talk possibilities and, you know, meet some cool people. And as I say, I'm always delighted to come over, so it's really any excuse.
Well, that's fantastic. And, of course, while you were here, you so of all the different evangelical megachurches in Houston, you went to Champion Forest Baptist Church. What drew you to that particular one?
Well, I met a guy called Mark Lanier, who is a very famous lawyer down in Texas, Christian apologist, writes some great books, and has this huge and just stunning kind of private theological library that he's had built in Northwest Houston. So I met him. Kind of the first thing I did on the Monday was to meet Jerry at this library and met Mark then. And then later on in the week, you know, I knew I was going to go to the Ordinariate Cathedral for vigil mass on the Saturday, which just kind of left Sunday morning free. And I still wanted to go to a mega church. Well, you know, at least a big, you know, the definitions. In fact, I'm not sure everyone always likes the term. But I wanted to go and, you know, experience, you know, kind of a big evangelical worship service. So I sent Mark an email and asked, you know, where he and his family worship. And he said, Champion Forest would be delighted to have you. So that's what we did.
Fantastic. And I want to get to that. Let's maybe take a side road for just a minute to talk about the cathedral of the Anglican Ordinariate. So for people who may not understand it, Pope Benedict XVI, who, of course, is the inspiration, the name behind the center where you teach, established this. It basically an opportunity for Anglicans who were drawn to the Catholic faith to enter into the church without leaving behind their patrimony. In other words, they could carry, you know, they had their own liturgical rite, from what I understand, and many dynamics from Anglicanism that are not, of course, incompatible with the Catholic faith. And so they've established this. It's almost like its own diocese of sorts, I guess, with its own cathedral.
Yeah, I mean, it works in the, I think canonically it works in the same way as, you know, the Ukrainian Catholic Eparchy or the Melkites. You know, they have it, it has its own structure. And the one in America, of course, has its own bishop, Bishop Lopes. And the ones in Britain and Australia have their own ordinaries. It works in the, at least in America, that it has personal parishes. So these are, they used to be very common in America, extraterritorial parishes catering to a certain constituency that kind of overlays the normal diocesan parish structure. And the one in Houston's been there for a long, I hadn't quite appreciated until I went to visit how long it's been there as, you know, kind of an Anglican Catholic community, because not only was the Ordinariate set up by Benedict XVI, but John Paul II in the 80s had set up what was called the Pastoral Provision, which, again, was a kind of a proto-Ordinariate that allowed Anglican priests to come over into full communion and with sort of carrying some of the riches of their liturgical and spiritual heritage with them. So, it's, I mean, it's an astonishing ecumenical gambit, really. You know, a recognition from the See of Peter that there are gifts that they can kind of bring back with them.
Not particularly appreciated by some in the Anglican hierarchy, I'm sure, but
No. Or indeed, I think in some areas of the Catholic hierarchy, I think it was patchy in the support and welcome that some of the communities received. But hey, that's the church.
I bet they have a beautiful liturgy, though.
They really do. And this is, I mean, one of the reasons I was so keen to go to the to see the Ordinariate in America was because I'd had the chance to visit there's an Ordinariate church in Oxford. And I'd happened, you know, it was a convenient time, and I'd been to the vigil mass there with my daughters, and it's an amazing liturgy. You know, it feels very much like a reformed version of the Tridentine Rite, because of course it's going right back to the Book of Common Prayer, and so it's an elevated style of English, but it's obviously in the vernacular. But it's, we're not here to talk about this, but it's if you get the chance to go, I really recommend it.
Well, fantastic. Yeah, so let's, I love the picture that you have on the front of the, or that put on the front of the Catholic Herald, describing your trip to the Evangelical Megachurch. We're here with Dr. Stephen Bullivant, director of the Benedict XVI Center for Religion Society at St. Mary's University in England. It's got a picture of donuts. So when you first walked into Champion Forest Baptist Church, what struck you about it besides the donuts?
Well, it was more, I think the thing that first struck me in was when we drove in, and, you know, you drive into this massive parking lot. And first of all, the fact, you know, a church having ample parking is a, you know, a joy in itself. But just the scale of the campus, really, because, you know, it's not just, you don't turn up and it's a church. You turn up and it's a whole kind of conference center, and there's basketball court, and, you know, a kind of a huge lecture room that they can use as a ballroom. And so it was really just the, not simply the church, but the infrastructure for educating and building community that exists around the worship space.
They sing a little bit better than we do typically, too, as well.
Well, they actually sing. I mean, and also, but also, you know, they've got a, I mean, there was, you know, this was, you know, there was a professional standard band on the stage. You know, there was a full choir. you know, there was proper amplification, and you know, you had the lyrics up on screen. So it was in a space designed for it, in a kind of a theatre style space that's, you know, that was designed for the acoustics. So they do sing.
And so go ahead.
No, I forget what I was going to say now.
It's early dementia. It happens to all of us. So, so you were, you know, after, I guess, the worship service, they had this large, for want of a better word, Sunday school class that Mark Lanier, this criminal lawyer, teaches. You said you were stunned by the size of it.
So Mark had once kind of said, oh, I'd like to come along. He's like, yeah, sure, come along. And then he was like, hey, wait, I teach this class after the service. It'd be great to, you know, bring you in and we can interview you and talk about the Trinity and atheism and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, coming from, you know, with my parochial background, both Catholic background and, you know, British background, my imagining of what, you know,
hey, let's hold on to that, Stephen.
Class. Yeah,
Stephen, sure. We got to go to a break. We'll come right back and we'll see how it blew away your expectations, and we'll get into the content of what you were discussing in the class. We'll be back in just a minute with Stephen Bullivant. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back into the Mike Allen Show. We'll continue my conversation here with Dr. Stephen Bullivant, who's the director of the Benedict the 16th Center for Religion and Society at St. Mary's University in Twickenham, England. He's also the author of the book, The Trinity, How Not to Be a Heretic. In fact, it was really this book, I guess, Stephen, that first got the attention of Mark Lanier, and that was the subject at the Champion Forest Baptist Church he wanted you to address with a larger-than-expected group.
Yeah, I was expecting about 12 for, you know, the kind of people who'd be willing to hang around after, you know, an hour and a half church service. It was a low attendance, I was told, because there was a big football game, but it was over 700 people, and it's typically around 1,000 who come along for this, and not just people who go to that service. You know, there's people who come from other churches, including Catholic ones, to come to Mark's class.
And Mark seems to be somebody who's very interested in good theology.
Oh, yeah, hugely. I mean, he's built sort of for his own ends, and although, you know, it's open to scholars and it's open to kind of interested folks, a vast, serious academic theology library. And he writes some wonderful things, apologetics, but his, you know, his biblical literacy classes, which I was part of, are hugely wide-ranging. I mean, you know, he has a very impressive day job, and it's amazing how he just finds the time. But he regards kind of the theology and pastoring and apologetics as his main thing. And, you know, his very successful law practice, you know, pays the bills and kind of a hobby.
Mm. Pretty impressive on a couple levels. I mean, impressive that he, as a passionate Baptist, you know, is not put off by a Catholic, and in particular, you know, a Catholic theologian, but also the fact that, you know, the crowd you spoke to sound like they were receptive and also very hungry for deeper things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was just lovely, really. You know, there was no shyness about making the sign of the cross, and, you know, on my part. And, you know, someone came up at the end who was brought up Catholic and, you know, was now a Baptist, who wanted to talk to me about the next book I've got coming out, which is on Fatima for the anniversary. So there was, you know, as an ecumenical encounter, it was just delightful. And it was also nice for me. I was telling a friend about this yesterday. It was, what was good for me was to talk, because we talked quite a bit about my conversion at the beginning of the class, and it was good for me to talk about my conversion in terms of coming to Jesus rather than kind of entering the church. Now, obviously, those two things are the same, precisely the same things, but there's a certain language that we don't use, that we don't frame things in, that it was good for me personally to kind of switch the language to talk on, you know, I guess what I expect to be the kind of the common ground term.
You know, I saw just the other day Pope Francis talked about that really the ecumenical project. I'm not sure he used those words, but basically that's only the unity is only going to be manifest in the church as we grow closer to Jesus, which I thought was a great, great point, because this is, you know, sometimes you have this sort of milquetoast ecumenism that I see, in which we sort of try to build a unity around the fact that none of us really believe very much of this stuff anyway.
Yeah.
But this is a vibrant type of ecumenism that's rooted in a common conviction that we can know the truth. The truth is a person. And, you realize that in some ways, there are some ways in which the commonalities between evangelical Protestants and Orthodox believing Catholics, it's almost like we have more in common sometimes than we do even with some within our own church.
Oh, absolutely. And also in terms of the real core, doctrines of Christology and the Trinity, we absolutely hold in common. This is one of the points I make in the How Not to Be a Heretic book, is that the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity and how it was kind of formulated over the early centuries is absolutely affirmed in all the main branches of Christianity. And I quote Calvin and Luther very much in support. In fact, John Calvin's account of the doctrine of the Trinity in the Institutes is just brilliant. But you could be reading Thomas. You could be reading Thomas Aquinas, the argumentation and the sources that they're appealing to, scripture and tradition, and magisterium, in fact, obviously, with the councils. There's a huge resource there for us to really realize the solid foundations on which we can build.
And it's, you know, it's interesting the title, the subtitle of your book there, because, you know, it's easy sometimes to see how we as Christians, even the most sincere, even the most devout of Catholics, we can find ourselves in talking about the Trinity without even being aware of it, drifting over into heresy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I wrote the book, because I think one of the difficulties we have is either people tell you the wrong thing, essentially, or a very partial account, because kind of that's what they overheard, you know, years ago. But I think that the bigger problem is that people don't talk about the Trinity because they don't want to say the wrong thing, and they're afraid of telling people the wrong thing, because they recognize that this is the heart of Christian message. This is, you know, the church's very most basic description of who God is. But they don't have the confidence to talk about that. That's why we get kind of, you know, Trinity Sunday sermons with an apologetic disclaimer about having drawn the short straw this week. And that's such missed opportunity, such a shame for Christianity. If the very heart of what it is we believe isn't something that we feel confident talking about.
And I'm sure you've seen the video from, I think, the group called Lutheran Satire, where they talk about St. Patrick's bad analogies.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I'll have to post that on the show's Facebook page for folks who haven't seen it. You know, I imagine, too, that talking about the Trinity, as you did here in this mega church with these very obviously sincere, hungry, Christians, who in some ways whose zeal can put many Catholic parishes to shame. But, you know, when you talk about the Trinity, it sounds like that's an opportunity for real ecumenical dialogue, because you can't, if you talk about the Trinity, you really have to talk about, you have to get beyond the New Testament. I mean, you have to get into those who grappled with this issue in the early centuries and the church councils, and then all of a sudden you're getting into something kind of Catholic.
Absolutely. So this is my reading. I mean, one of the things I try and do in the book, and I think one of the important things, is people often get the second half of that and think that Trinity and some of the technical language that we use, like consubstantial and hypostasis, is kind of not scriptural at all, and it's kind of later church tradition and that kind of stuff. So the trick really is to show how all this is deeply rooted in the scriptures, and the reason why the early church and the church fathers needed to coin some of these phrases and have these councils was in order to protect the kind of the raw material in the scripture. And this is precisely the point that Calvin makes, and it's precisely the point that Thomas Aquinas makes, that the reason why these new terms get coined, these non-biblical terms, is precisely to protect the authentic biblical testimony.
Well, it was because
so the two work in harmony.
It was really the experience of Jesus that kind of rattled their experience of these monotheists. You know, they knew this one was more than just a human being, but how do they reconcile this with what they know about God? And that's, you know, and that's of course deeply ingrained, as you said, in the scriptures. But scripture has to be interpreted, right? So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we see this gradual unpacking of the just mind-blowing events of the first century that, you know, the earliest disciples, you know, can barely take in as they're happening. I mean, you know, this
right.
is, you know, the incarnation, you know, and everything that follows from it. And, you know, to be able to find ways of talking about that, on the one hand, with the existing language and categories, remembering that we're trying to talk about God Almighty here, so our language is always going to, be lacking. To do that with the existing categories, but realizing that kind of the reality explodes them to an extent, this is critical. You know, one of the chapters in the book is called Rereading the Old Testament, because obviously once Christ comes along and a group of Jews realize that he is the one that the Old Testament was talking about, then it's only natural that they then reinterpret the Old Testament in that key and in light of the new revelation that's kind of come from God himself standing among us.
Well, Stephen, we're unfortunately getting close to being out of time. I really appreciate it, and I'm going to make sure that the link to this interview that you had so people can watch it in full. I think it's really good, too, that you could be there and talk about your love for Jesus, because I think sometimes the concept from some evangelicals is that Catholics don't really love Jesus. And so for you to be able to bear witness to that is a great thing, too. So thanks for your great work, and I hope to have you on again sometime soon.
Great.
And when's that book on Fatima coming out?
May. Oh, My Jesus, the Meaning of the Fatima Prayer.
Fantastic. Perfectly timed for the centennial, huh?
Yeah.
Stephen, blessings to you, and Godspeed, okay? Well, blessings to your family. We'll be back in just a minute with Jason Hall in the second hour. This is The Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.